This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, December 6th, and we'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current and Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. And we'll speak with CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. This week, a problem with the security of spent nuclear fuel has been discovered at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. And two Woods Hole scientists speak publicly about the proposed release of radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay. Also, plans for a new school campus with amenities open to the public are shaping up in Hyannis. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is joining us now with all those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So we've reported about some safety violations at the Pilgrim nuclear plant in the past, but this one is different. It's about the storage of spent nuclear fuel. And the fuel is stored outdoors in these huge concrete containers called casks. What do we know about what this violation was about?
Well, we know that it's considered security related. A federal inspection in November found one or more violations. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says it is related to fuel storage. But I do want to be careful not to be alarmist here, because the documentation, what little is available publicly, says the inspectors were looking at the security plan, the procedures, the records, things like that. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not release details when it's a security issue. So we don't know the exact nature of the violation, really, or how immediate or serious it was. But we do know they were reviewing procedures and documentation. Neil Sheehan, who is the spokesperson for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, told me they don't release information on security violations because, naturally, they don't want to divulge anything that could expose any vulnerabilities in security at the plant. But he did tell me that in response to the findings during the inspection, Holtec, the owner of Pilgrim, did put measures in place to sort of correct that or, mitigate that before the inspectors left the property.
So we know there was a security violation, but we don't know what it was about. Do we know what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is trying to do about it?
Well, the documentation is brief, but it says this is being considered for what is known as an escalated enforcement action. I know that some escalated enforcements do result in a fine, but there are many factors that go into a decision on that. Holtec is allowed to request a conference or submit a written response. The government reviews that and then issues a letter about the significance of the violation. I'm hoping that letter is public, but I'm going to check into that.
So the owner of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station that's in the process of decommissioning it, this is the company Holtec. What did they have to say about this violation?
Well, they said that they can't comment because of the security nature of the issue. Their spokesman, Patrick O'Brien, did tell me they are focused on decommissioning Pilgrim and doing it in a way that is safe and secure. Hmm.
We're going to stick with Pilgrim for a bit here because we haven't talked on the News Roundup since before Thanksgiving, and last week was an interesting week. That's when two scientists from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution spoke publicly about Holtec's plan to discharge radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay. First, tell us who was involved and a little bit of the backstory, how this came about.
Sure. So they spoke at the latest meeting of the state panel on Pilgrim. The scientists who spoke were Ken Bissler and Irina Rapina. Bissler is a marine radiochemist, so he studies radioactivity in the ocean. And Rapina is a physical oceanographer. And at least in this context, she studies how ocean waters transport materials. So both of them have spoken to the media before about the potential discharge of radioactive water from Pilgrim and what would happen to it. And some written comments that Bissler had made to the State Department of Public Health about the water at Pilgrim had been the subject of debate at a previous meeting without him present. And so the panel decided to invite him to address them directly, and apparently Irina Rapinoe was invited as well because she has been involved in this public conversation.
What's at stake here for anyone who hasn't been following along closely? About 1 million gallons of water that's contaminated and has radioactivity in it. Holtec is proposing to release that into Cape Cod Bay. What was the message that these two scientists brought to the nuclear panel that's looking at this?
Irina Rapinoe presented some data about how ocean currents could transport pollution that's released at Pilgrim through Cape Cod Bay and in Cape Cod Bay. And she said the probability of pollution leaving the bay without going near the shoreline, excuse me, is virtually zero in winter and fall. It would be going near the shoreline. And then in spring and summer, it's a little higher, but still a low probability of it leaving the bay without going near the shoreline.
So those you're talking about the shoreline of Cape Cod, towns along that
Right. So
shoreline.
that, right. Yeah. So the inner shoreline of Cape Cod, is kind of where, the water in the bay circulates.
Dennis
And
and Wellfleet, Provincetown. Yes.
yes, those are some of the towns that she mentioned in particular were places where it would be likely to go near the shoreline. Thank you for naming those. For Bissler's comments, he said the way that radioactive elements would accumulate in the bay, of course, would vary depending on what the radioactive element is, and then the item you're testing. So is it water? Is it fish, sediment, things like that? And his recommendation was that those levels of radioactivity be tested before, during, and after any release of radioactive water.
What does Bissler think is the best way to deal with this radioactive water at the Pilgrim nuclear plant? It's right now it's evaporating into the open air, but it's still nearly 1 million gallons.
That's right. Well, he's not necessarily pushing a specific plan, but he did say that one option would be to remove as much of the harmful radioactive materials from the water as possible and then store the water until the tritium can decay. You'll remember that the tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, and so it's very difficult, essentially impossible, to remove it from this much water in this case. And so he says if you went with the storage option, though, and it were stored for 60 years, more than 95% of that radioactivity from tritium would be gone from the water. And he also said that, even though nuclear plants do release radioactive water when they're operating, that in his view, doing it when the plant is closed would set a precedent, globally, really, about using the ocean to dispose of nuclear waste.
How about the reaction from Holtec supporters to this? Was it a civil discussion?
Yes, it was. And we learned something interesting from Holtec during this discussion. David Noyes, who is a compliance manager at Holtec and speaks for the company frequently at these meetings, gave a more specific estimate than we've heard before of what the treated water would have in it if it were discharged into the bay. He said that treating the water would reduce the radioactivity to a level comparable to what was released in 2015 when the plant was operating. He said those levels from 2015 essentially show what the treatment system is capable of.
And we have one more piece of Pilgrim news to talk about. The state says Holtec now wants to evaporate something else, not the radioactive water. What is that?
Right, yes, this is sodium pentaborate. The State Department of Environmental Protection says Holtec notified them they want to evaporate 4,000 gallons of this sodium pentaborate solution into the outdoor air as well. And this substance is something that Pilgrim kept on hand as an emergency measure to shut down the reactor if the normal methods for doing that were to not work in an emergency. Sodium pentaborate absorbs neutrons, and so it can be used for that purpose. But the state said it doesn't want Holtec to do this evaporation without first looking at whether the state hazardous waste regulations would apply.
I want to take a few minutes here to look at a very different story now, and it's one that could be particularly interesting for people on the Mid-Cape. This is about the Riverview School. They have plans for a new campus, And now the campus will be larger than originally planned. Tell us about what's happening here.
Sure. The Riverview School is a private school in East Sandwich, and it had previously bought the Twin Brooks Golf Course in Hyannis. The golf course is 40 acres, and that is for a new campus. They have now purchased the conference center abutting the golf course, which adds about 6 acres, and it allows the school to use that conference center building for programs, which also then gives them some more flexibility about what to do with the golf course land. And some of the ideas that they are talking about include opening a farm stand and general store, and that would be open to the public, and then public walking trails as well. Riverview is a school for students who have complex learning challenges. So this campus is important for them as well as for these potential community amenities, because right now, programs at that school end at age 22. Students lose their supportive community. So they want to do that for adults here on this campus. But they want the campus to have a lot of interaction with the broader community as well. And so that is where some of those things like the farm stand come in.
And right now, the conference center is part of it's called the Irish Village Hotel property. But the school isn't buying the hotel. Is that right? Can you explain how this is all going to work?
Yes, the conference center is part of the Emerald Resort, but that complex is very commonly called the Irish Village. My understanding is that the Irish Village name is that technically refers to just the hotel portion of the complex. The school is buying the Highport Conference Center, which is attached to the hotel. And Riverview says it is working with the owner of the Irish Village, as well as the Barnstable Land Trust and others, on kind of an overall plan and vision for how these properties and buildings can work well together. I will say that construction, they said, is still a couple of years away because they're really just at the beginning.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Some 300 cold-stunned sea turtles that washed up in Wellfleet and surrounding towns have been rushed to an animal hospital run by the New England Aquarium. CAI's Eve Zukoff went there to the animal hospital to speak with the people working to save the turtles. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This happens to some degree each year.
Yes.
So the aquarium folks are expecting turtles, and they're prepared to treat them. But describe a sea turtle hospital for us. What kind of space is it physically, and what is happening inside?
Yeah, it was my first time to the sea turtle hospital after kind of covering this story almost on the release end, the back end of this work for a few years now. But the hospital itself is in this kind of converted warehouse in Quincy. It's right on a dock, and there are dozens of staff and interns and volunteers just buzzing around, especially when you actually hear the doorbell ring, the buzz, and they know that there's a new shipment in of turtles. And as soon as they come in, there's this rush to start getting them into a clinic or an X-ray room. And then the centerpiece kind of all of this hospital is the tanks where the turtles are swimming. Again, 300 of them right now, mostly separated within the species because there can be some fighting, especially during feeding time. They've got some spunk, these turtles. So there's the loggerhead, the green, the Kemp's Ridleys. And when you kind of peer into these tanks, you see the variation. Some of the turtles are at the bottom with wrapped up flippers. They're not moving very much. And some are right at the top, splashing you as you walk by, starting to clearly feel a little bit better. And it's a real range as you go through.
So these are turtles that are cold stunned when the volunteers pick them up off the beaches and they race them over to the animal hospital. While you were there, a new shipment of these sea turtles were brought in. What happens? How do they treat the animals as they bring them in the door?
Yeah, so the turtles come in banana boxes, literally like what you see from the grocery stores.
Like the cardboard?
The cardboard boxes. They're just the right size for these turtles, and they're kind of protected. And so, they're driven up by volunteers who say that they drive very quietly to try to give some calm to these turtles. And then right away, it becomes very intense. Staff and volunteers, they're taking pictures of the turtles. They're marking them with numbers. They're trying trying to get the heart rate. And to do that, they actually use a fetal heart rate monitor, literally what an OBGYN might use. So they push one end of the Doppler, this little remote-looking thing, to the fleshy neck of a turtle and put the other end with a speaker up to their ears, and then they count beats per minute. And then based on that first intake, they're making decisions about who needs to be treated for sepsis or pneumonia or injured flippers, bloodied faces. But they do have years of data and experience doing this. So they've found that around 80% of their turtle patients will survive with this kind of care.
Now, Cape Cod, we know, is a hot spot, or maybe we should say a cold spot for sea turtle strandings this time of year. Explain why that is.
Yeah, I mean, each fall, as water temperatures drop in the North Atlantic, loggerhead, green, and Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, who've spent their summers in Cape Cod Bay, where it's lovely and abundant with food and everything else, they try to begin their southern migration. But Cape Cod's flexed arm, really out towards Provincetown, it acts as a trap. So the turtles are in the bay as the temperatures drop, and then the wind blows them closer to shore, where they just wash up on beaches. And yeah, this has been happening for decades. The aquarium's been running their hospital since the 70s, but it's really gotten worse. In the early 2000s, the hospital was treating something like 40 sea turtles a year. And if current trends continue, I mean, this year they could reach 1,000 admits in 2024. And by 2030, modeling suggests the number could be even higher year over year.
And this is interesting. Experts attribute this increase in part to climate change.
Yeah, I mean, historically, sea turtles didn't really go north of Massachusetts because the Gulf of Maine was too cold. But now it's one of the fastest, possibly the fastest warming body of water in the world. And with the warming of the Gulf, turtles are just like pushing north for longer periods of time, especially Kemp's Ridley's. So then as they try to migrate south, more of them are funneling into Cape Cod Bay, especially younger ones. They really like to stay towards the shore.
So what will happen next for these hospitalized sea turtles?
Yeah, I mean, this is triage stage. So the aquarium cannot keep hundreds at their facility. Many of them, most of them, will be loaded onto planes and flown to other sea turtle hospitals in the next few weeks. They'll stay there probably for months of treatment. It's a donation-based organization called Turtles Fly 2 that really organizes this, and others help with that. But there will be about 40 to 70 turtles that will stay in the Quincy Hospital run by the aquarium. They will get individualized care. They'll get names. Greek gods is the theme this year. I can't wait to meet Athena when she is released on a Cape Cod beach next summer. That is the plan, to get these turtles all back to the wild.
Okay, there are some great photos of the turtles in the hospital on our website, capeandislands.org. Eve, let's talk about another story that you covered, a 13-year effort to restore cranberry bogs to freshwater wetlands and native grasslands has just been completed in Mattapoisett. Tell us about what had to be done to the area to make this possible.
Yeah, so this was an effort launched by the Buzzards Bay Coalition, and for 13 years, they have been working to do things like remove culverts, buried pipes, irrigation tubing, large portions of dikes to naturalize the flow of water. And then they had to scrape, this part is amazing to me, a foot of sand off of the wetlands to get back down to the hydrology pre-cranberry growing. It was extensive, extensive work. Mm. But now the newly restored wetlands and grasslands will be better able to absorb and filter water moving into the nearby Mattapoisett River, which feeds Buzzards Bay, and, of course, the public drinking water supply for, you know, 30,000 people in Fairhaven, Mattapoisett, Marion, and Rochester. And the wetlands will be able to better absorb water, which is a necessity when climate change makes storms more intense, too.
It's a big property, 55-acre property. It's now ready for visitors, is that right?
Yes. The Buzzards Bay Coalition, with their partners, they built 5 bridges and 2 boardwalks to enhance this, like, 2-mile trail network. The main parking lot and trailhead is at 141 Acushnet Road in Mattapoisett. While we were there, some folks were already out dog walking, and I didn't see any, but apparently there are egrets, osprey, toads, and turtles that are also already in the area.
Okay, one last story for today. Last week on Thanksgiving, you shared the story of how Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies rescued their first entangled whale 40 years ago on Thanksgiving Day. We don't have time to get all the way into this, but tell us a little bit about the significance of this tale.
Yeah, well, the actual story of the disentanglement of Ibis the humpback whale is incredible. I found myself holding my breath while Stormy Mayo told it to me. I hope people will read it online. It to me, is worth it. But Mayo reflected on it as something that not only was immensely gratifying, the first ever center's disentanglement effort, and it was successful, and it had movie-like qualities, but he said it's really significant because it was the beginning for an organization that has gone on to rescue hundreds, possibly thousands more, whales and other sea life, and teach those same methods to other marine mammal specialists around the world. So it was the beginning of a very rich and important history, not only for the whales that get disentangled, but for all of their future offspring that continue on, the lineage.
It's a great story. You can find it on our website, capeandislands.org. CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Thanks, Eve.
Thank you.
A rare white deer, a stag, has been sighted on Martha's Vineyard and is making a stir on social media. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this story. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
This deer, being a wild animal, is somewhat elusive. Tell us how islanders have been seeing it and sharing images.
Yeah, we've seen a couple on Facebook, some shared with us. And I think the reaction is really, amazement or awe when you come across one. This one has been spotted in West Tisbury. I think a lot of cultures have different meanings behind these kind of mythical creatures, you might say. Some represents that the underworld is near, I guess. Others, it's kind of hope. Some it's, leave it alone and respect nature. One firsthand account we heard I thought was neat. The woman saying she tried not to, attach too much meaning to it, but said, it was right around the election and she wasn't feeling great about the results. And this signified that maybe everything would be okay, that, this was maybe a good message or something like that.
So it is this all-white deer. I mean, just so people can imagine this is.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure listeners who haven't seen an image of this, it's an all-white deer that has antlers?
Right, yeah, it's a stag. It's called a piebald. So there's a little disagreement over what, there are albino deer, which are, completely white. They have red eyes, which are incredibly rare. And one state biologist we spoke to says he doesn't think it's an albino. He thinks it's what it's called a piebald, which has some pigment of brown in it, like a normal deer. But what is really interesting with piebalds, or sad, you might say, is they have like some genetic mutations that come with it, like a spine that, has some problems, or club feet. And strangely, the state kind of says we encourage hunting these, which puts that, it's an interesting perspective. You have this myth, almost mystic realm to it, but at the same time, the state is saying, well, they're not, we kind of want to take these out of the gene pool because they're not great.
Well, we know that the island has plenty of deer, and it has a strong deer hunting community. You reached out to some deer hunters to find out what happens if you come across an all-white deer in the woods while you're out hunting for deer.
Yeah, I thought this was really, it's one thing seeing a white deer, but I thought this part of the story was really interesting. We talked to a couple of hunters. Some are saying, it's just not practical to have a piebald deer because you're just not meaty. I think one wrinkle is, you're not going to ruin all this fun around this really neat creature. You don't want to be that guy who kind of takes out a white deer. But I think also really interesting, there's this kind of myth, and some think it started out west, where if you take out a white deer, it comes with bad luck. I think one rumor is, you wouldn't be able to bag a deer forever after taking it out. And one hunter I talked to really bought into that. I'm not shooting it.
He said it's super bad mojo to shoot something like that. That was one hunter you spoke with.
Yeah, Brian Atherton, who's kind of a big hunter on the island. I think that's kind of, it seems like He also did say, I thought it was kind of interesting, he spoke with some other hunters who were kind of might go out and try to target it. Like, we're going to go out and find this. So it's kind of we didn't hear anyone who told us that directly, but it is, you know, it's an interesting thing. You see this really neat deer, but there is a little bit of an interesting backstory to it. Mm.
Let me ask you about another story this week. An island tradition continued last week with the Island Cup football game between Nantucket and the Vineyard. And this time it was held in a very auspicious neutral site. Tell us about the game, and then we can talk about the outcome.
Yes, obviously, yeah, Fenway Park, which obviously if you're a kid growing up in New England, probably have dreams of playing there. And I know this was last week, but I just wanted to get an opportunity to get on the radio. It's just such a great story that these kids got to go up there. We sent a reporter, actually our publisher was there, and just got to see, you know, these students going into the, you know, the Red Sox dugout, going through kind of the tunnel out into the field, and even the coaches were kind of, you know, overcome with the awe and kind of, you know, awesomeness of Fenway Park.
So the two teams from Nantucket and the Vineyard traveled up to Fenway Park to play a football game. And this is, you know, part of the traditional rivalry. Tell us about the game itself.
Yeah, right. Sorry. This is the Island Cup. And ultimately, Nantucket took it home, which the Vineyards won the last couple of years. So a little disappointment there. But overall, a really great game. It was live streamed. We actually got to watch it. We were kind of all watching it in the newsroom, which was a lot of fun. But Nantucket kind of came out with an early lead, and the Vineyard was kind of struggling early, but kind of bounced back and made this really miraculous comeback. And it looked like they were going to win the game kind of at the end. But ultimately it went into overtime, and kind of this epic back and forth ended in overtime with Nantucket winning. But we had a little essay in our paper just saying, you know, it was a great, nothing to hang our heads about for the Vineyard athletes. Just a great game and a lot of fun.
That is Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sam, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Chatham is changing the way its fire department responds to calls. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Chatham is going to be outsourcing its fire dispatch. I think we can say that. The plan is for Barnstable County dispatchers to take over?
That's correct. The Barnstable County Sheriff's Office Regional Emergency Communications Center at Joint Base Cape Cod will be taking on the Chatham Fire Department's dispatch function. This isn't slated to happen until about the middle of next year. Basically, Chatham is joining about 10 other Cape communities and fire departments in having the Sheriff's Department dispatch their fire services, fire and emergency medical services. And right now, the Sheriff's Office also dispatches 911 for, I believe, most of the Cape, including Chatham. So if you call 911, you get the Sheriff's Office, and they direct your call to police or fire services. Starting the middle of next year, when you call the Chatham Fire Department's emergency number, you'll get the county dispatch, and they will basically triage your emergency and send the appropriate response to that. Now, this has sort of been in the works for a number of years. Chatham was solicited to join this system more than a decade ago, but the town wasn't ready to do it at that point. But now Fire Chief Justin Tavano said this is the thing that they need to do now, because it's going to basically free up one firefighter per shift to be devoted to emergency responses rather than sitting in the station answering phone calls.
So tell us a little bit about that then. That means that Chatham will have more people to respond to emergencies, because right now one of these fire responders has to actually be answering the calls when people come in. They can't go out.
That's correct. So the town has four shifts of firefighters, paramedics, and they work 24 hours at a time. And there are seven people on each shift. Now, if a call comes in and an ambulance is dispatched, there are enough personnel left in the station in order to respond to a second call. But when there's a second call, the person who's been assigned as the dispatcher for the shift usually has to go on that call, and the town or the department then has to call back a off-duty firefighter to help with dispatch at that point. Under this system, they won't have to do that because they'll be dispatching from off-site. So that basically it provides, it's like hiring an extra firefighter, the fire chief said. And, you know, that, you know, it's the equivalent of when you count those four shifts that the town has, it's an equivalent of about four firefighters, which the fire chief said equals about $400,000 worth of salary and benefits. Now, going over to the county system is going to cost the town money as well, but significantly less than that. It's going to cost anywhere between $55,000 and $100,000 annually. The department or the town is charged on the basis of each of the number of people in town who are residents, and that amount is offset by state funding. At this point, they're just sort of projecting what it's going to cost because they haven't got a figure yet for how much the state funding is going to offset for fiscal 2026, which starts next July, and that's about when Chatham will be joining this system.
Let me ask you about one other story this week. The town has rallied around a restaurant owner and his staff after a car accidentally drove through the front of the restaurant and injured some folks. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so this incident happened about 9:20 a.m. on November 27th. A 71-year-old Chatham resident drove her Toyota RAV4 through the front door of Larry's PX, which is a pretty iconic a breakfast and lunch eatery in West Chatham. It's been around for over five decades. Everybody goes there. Everybody knows it. The car rammed through the front of the restaurant all the way almost to the kitchen in the back. It pinned a member of the staff against the counter. She was her name is Leah Moxham. She was pretty severely injured. She had to be taken by ambulance to Boston, and she underwent several surgeries. And a patron in the restaurant was also hurt. But because of that damage, the restaurant's going to be closed, and that puts about more than a half dozen people out of work for we don't know how long at this point. Mm. So the Pals for Life organization, which is a nonprofit that helps out people in the restaurant and hotel industry when they fall on hard times or have an emergency, they contributed over $23,000, and other folks also through a GoFundMe page contributed money. So there's been over $50,000 raised to help these Larry's employees pay their bills, basically. There are also separate GoFundMe pages for Leah Moxham and for other members of the staff, and those fundraisers are ongoing, and you can find links to them on our website, CapeCodChronicle.com.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. On Nantucket, opening a great pond to the ocean is an annual occurrence. A piece of enormous construction machinery digs through the sandbar separating the pond from the sea, allowing an exchange of fresh water and salt water. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current has the story of why this year things are a little different. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This pond opening happened this week, and this time around, I guess some folks from the scientific communities are participating to better understand what's happening. Is that right?
That's right. So on earlier this week, the Natural Resources Department did its semi-annual opening of Sacagawea Pond, which is one of the great ponds on the island along the eastern shoreline. And as you mentioned, connecting it to the ocean with a breach through the sand, you know, allowing that exchange of the brackish pond waters with the offshore waters. You know, this has been done for decades to allow the entry of marine species to lower nitrogen levels and raise salinity in the ponds. This year we were joined by a master's research student who is going to be conducting a new research project to sort of verify and those assumptions that we make about the value and the impact of doing these pond breaches, and looking at the, you know, if those impacts on water quality are indeed, you know, what the extent of them are, and are there ways to do it better, to time it better during the year. So they were there on site, you know, checking, you know, doing monitoring with drones, with photos, taking water samples as the pond was opened, and we'll be doing that throughout the week to get a better sort of picture of the impact of doing these pond openings.
The pond openings are so, it's almost like a sandworks project that kids do on the beach, but done large scale. And the images that you have of the machines just essentially cutting a channel from the pond to the sea, they're just remarkable images.
Yeah, it's really a sight to see, and, you know, folks come out. You know, people say this is one of the fun, what do you do in the off season? Well, you know, we'll go to the pond opening on the beach and check it out. And, you know, there was a little crowd there earlier this week to see Sacagawea get opened. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we had the researcher there and she was, you know, talking about the process of capturing images, capturing water samples, you know, before the opening, during, and once it closes up again.
Jason, let me ask you about another story. Nantucket Pharmacy on Main Street has been slated to close. We've talked about this in the past. The owner of the longtime business saying that it's just too hard for independent pharmacies to operate these days. But this week there's word that rumors of its demise may be premature. Is that right?
Yes, that Nantucket Pharmacy on Main Street, this is a you know, sort of iconic downtown staple that's been around for nearly 100 years, and it's really a throwback to an earlier time. It's got the classic soda fountain, just a real beloved business, downtown business. And earlier this year, as we reported, they, you know, had been searching for a successor. The longtime owner and pharmacist have been at this for, you know, 30, 40 years and are ready to move on. We're struggling to find a successor given all of the pressures on small independent pharmacies. And just, you know, as he said, as Alan Bell said, it's just a bad business model and they're getting squeezed by insurance companies and it's just become really challenging. So when they couldn't find anyone, they, you know, were set to close this weekend, close the pharmacy, close the soda fountain. And that was all in the works, but got word this week from Alan Bell that there he has a deal in place, hopefully, to bring in a successor. They've submitted a letter of intent to the Board of Pharmacy, the state board, and they are going to stay open through the end of the year while this deal gets worked out. So there is hope, and it came as great relief to a lot of people in the community who were, you know, really upset to hear that this business was winding down. So hopefully a second life here now for Nantucket Pharmacy.
But not any details or a lot of details about who this might be.
Not yet. He wanted to make sure that this deal gets finalized before, you know, talking about who these people are, but did say they have experience in the pharmacy space, have run pharmacies elsewhere, and do have a connection to Nantucket, own a house here. So looking forward to finding out what this group is, who they are, but sounds promising from what Alan at Nantucket Pharmacy told us.
Hmm. That is Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
As prices for housing continue to climb in Provincetown, the town is now eyeing changes to zoning to ensure that commercial properties, storefronts, continue to remain storefronts. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Steve.
I'm Steve. A number of significant properties along Commercial Street are going on the market. Explain what's at stake here for the town if these don't remain commercial properties.
Well, you know, the select board chair just laid it out as, do you want to have places to shop and do you want to have places to eat? The general pressure is that, you know, the residential market is so, so hot for single family homes especially, but also condos, that commercial properties, including restaurants, including retail, art galleries, hardware stores, all kinds of things up and down Commercial Street are at risk of converting into residential, and that has happened to some extent. Some of the art galleries, the old office of the Provincetown Banner is going to be residential, and there's a few restaurants that have closed recently that looks like that's the direction those properties might be headed as well. So the planning board came up with this idea as a way to essentially make those conversions no longer possible on the main stretch of Commercial Street.
So the idea here is to create what they call an overlay district. Is that right? Kind of a different set of zoning rules to make sure that these properties, when they change hands, aren't removed from being commercial properties.
Yes, it doesn't apply to the entire zoning district of the town center or of the residential one or residential two. It just creates a sort of like a sub-district that's only the properties that face Commercial Street, running from Franklin in the West End, Divorce Lane in the East End. And only those properties that face Commercial Street would be affected by this bylaw.
And it does allow for some of these properties, or some part of the property, I guess, to be converted into residential use, but it's requiring that a significant portion remains commercial no matter what happens. Is that right?
Yes, it's at least half of the ground floor, and specifically the half that faces Commercial Street. So you can convert the back half to residential, anything on an upper story, and that can be, you know, one unit or more than one unit, depending on how you want to divide it up. They just want the front half that faces commercial on the ground floor to remain a commercial use that's inviting to pedestrians and to people who are, you know, walking down the street.
How do they define commercial use? Do they have an idea of what they're looking for here?
They provided a very long list, including bar, restaurant, retail, art gallery, meeting halls, banks, almost any kind of business you can think of that serves a customer is specifically named in the bylaw as being allowed.
Does it feel like an idea that has some momentum gathering behind it? Is this something that's going to happen? Does it seem that way?
I think it's definitely something that people are going to talk about a lot. You know, the planning board chair predicted there would be controversy, and that wouldn't surprise me either. The residential real estate market is very hot. There's a lot of money at stake. So, you know, anytime that's the case, you're going to hear a lot of people having things to say about it. I think it's an idea that, because there have been a few conversions, doesn't feel theoretical. And there have been some restaurants off of Commercial Street that have closed as well. So that doesn't feel, you know, theoretical. Nappy's restaurant is gone now. That was an institution for many decades. And so it just seems like something that people are going to want to talk about, whether it happens or not. You know, it would be an April town meeting vote.
Can I ask you just briefly, because housing is so such a difficult issue for Provincetown, they are looking for ways to increase housing through accessory dwelling units. Is that right?
Yes, and they've been relaxing the ADU rules to make them more enticing to build. You know, at one point they had to be affordable rentals and nobody built one. And then they had to be year-round only rentals and still nobody built one. So they've relaxed it down to just no short-term rentals. Like, if you want to rent it seasonally, or if you want to, you know, have your family come stay there in the off-season, whatever. But they're now looking at actually offering some of the short-term rental tax money as payments. $10,000 to help you get through permitting and design, and then another $10,000 after you finish construction as inducements to try to add more ADUs.
And so these would be payments, incentives, essentially, to encourage people to go ahead and build these accessory dwelling units.
Yes, they're expensive to build. So there's also a conversation about how do you make them cheaper? How do you maybe pre-approve designs or pre-approve components? How can you work with permitting so that it's easier, so that these are cheaper to build?
Mm. A lot there in the story. You can find it in the Provincetown Independent. Paul Benson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. If you or someone you know has had trouble finding a doctor, perhaps that's no surprise. The Cape continues to have a shortage of healthcare providers. CAI's Gilda Geist has more details on this and joins us. Hi, Gilda.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us about this new study, which really affirms something that feels like common knowledge, namely that it's really hard to get a medical appointment on Cape Cod.
Yeah, so this sort of update on the healthcare situation on Cape Cod came out of a study commissioned by Barnstable County. It specifically looks at healthcare issues in the Lower Cape region, but Kathleen O'Neill from the county's Health and Environment Department says a lot of the study results apply to the entire Cape. It is absolutely common knowledge that it's hard to get a doctor's appointment here, but it's always good to have numbers. I think some of the stats that really struck me had to do with the ratio of patients to providers and how Cape Cod compares to the rest of the state in that regard. So, for example, Massachusetts has a little over 600 residents per primary care provider. On Cape Cod, though, there are well over 1,000 residents for every primary care provider. Mm. So this is essentially a supply and demand problem.
And not just even primary care providers. Providers, they have, like, there's dentists, there's pediatricians, OBGYNs, mental health. It's a whole range that are disproportionately a large number of people seeking out a small number of providers here. The study also looked at the implications for the Cape's disproportionately older population.
Yeah, so the Lower Cape is home to two towns that hold the second and third place spots for the highest median age in all of Massachusetts. That's Chatham, where the median age is 64, and Orleans, where the median is 63. And that would be fine if all of our elders had everything they needed to live comfortable and healthy lives. But for a lot of people, that's not the case. And the study found that one in every 10 people over 65 live alone. And if you're older and you have mobility issues, or maybe you don't drive anymore, it's going to make it challenging to do things like get to doctor's appointments, buy food, etc. The study also identified other groups that faced barriers in the healthcare realm. Non-English speakers, for example. The study found that more than 6% of residents in Brewster and Harwich speak a language other than English, and navigating the healthcare system already is not easy, and adding a language barrier certainly doesn't help. The study also noted that while most Lower Cape residents were wealthy, there were significant wealth disparities. And this is important to note because a lot of people think the Cape is a place for rich people, and while you could certainly argue that it is, you can't deny that there are some folks here who struggle to meet their basic needs, and that includes healthcare.
I want to talk about another story that you reported this week. You spoke with someone with one of the more unusual jobs that you can have. This is Tom Kumela. Tell us about him and why he's come to Nantucket.
Yeah, Tom Kumela is a Coast Guard certified lampist. And that basically means it's his job to travel around the country and care for lighthouse lenses. So back in the day, lampists would go around to service their assigned lighthouses once per year. Nowadays, a lot of those lenses are out of service and are instead at museums. And that includes this one particular lens at the Nantucket Shipwreck and Lifesaving Museum, which was due for a checkup, and Tom Kumela was hired to do the job.
I thought this was such an interesting conversation. Even the way that he became a lampist seems surprising.
Yeah, Tom says there is no manual for being a lampist. In fact, you have to learn how to do it through an apprenticeship. So Tom was a construction worker in New York City for most of his life, and he would basically use his vacation time to go train as an apprentice. He said his mentors would try to schedule the jobs in coordination with his schedule, because if you can believe it, being a lampist is not really a full-time job in today's day and age. Back in the day, if you were a lampist, you'd spend time between jobs at a depot working on building the lenses themselves and shipping them out. But now that's not really part of the job anymore.
So what can you tell us about the work he's doing with the Nantucket lens? This was the lens from the lighthouse that's now being displayed in a sort of historic fashion.
Yeah, so there's like a ton of steps and parts to a lighthouse lens. But from what I gather, the most important parts are the prisms. A lens might have hundreds of prisms, and they're arranged in a way that allows the light to be focused into one beam. And over time, these prisms can get chipped, they can crack, they can get loose. And so Tom's job is to go around, look for signs of damage, and fix it.
And clean it. He seemed to have a real reverence for these lenses, their Fresnel lenses, and for how working on them connects directly to the past.
Yeah, Tom says he sees being a lampist as a privilege. He's really struck by being able to interact with something so historic. He told me he's 62 years old, and not only are most of the lenses older than him, they've actually been out of service longer than he's been alive. And being a lampist, Tom understands just how many people went into the making of these lenses, and he just loves his job.
We've got photos of Tom at work on Nantucket on our website, CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thanks.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Heard from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current and Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. And we heard there from CAI's Gilda Geist. Big thanks to Amy Vince for engineering the program. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.